So for this month's conversation, so I actually chose the topic of artificial intelligence in medicine. Artificial intelligence has been in the news a lot lately, and it's going to be more and more because it's such a rapidly growing and advancing field. What really got me interested in it, and remember, we focused normally in this discussion, in this tech study group, on medical ethics. And so even though there could be interesting things happening in the world, you know, the focus is on medical ethics and Torah sources that relate to it. And also I like to try to use my own experience normally. And I have some experience when it comes to, you know, medicine and hospitals, working in a hospital. But artificial intelligence is really, you know, this rapidly advancing field. And what does it have to do with medicine? And what does it have to do with hospitals? But then I noticed we're having a staff meeting, a leadership meeting here in the hospital that I work for, Cedars-Sinai, about 2 months ago, and they introduced a new department here in our hospital. The name of the department, in fact, I could pull up the name of it, but I'll just so you can know the exact specifics, the name of the department is the Department of Computational Biomedicine. But it's essentially a department that's working on AI and artificial intelligence. And they hired like 12 people, full-time, you know, PhD researchers who are doing incredible work. And there's this whole department. I actually went to visit them because I wanted to know more and learn from them. And I thought, like, why is the hospital investing so much in artificial intelligence? And then over the recent months, you know, there's also another list that I'm on is like this email list of like innovations in the hospital. And whenever new things come out, and literally, you know, at big academic medical centers like Cedars-Sinai, it's like five or six published, you know, new innovations a week, sometimes more than that. Sometimes it's 15, 20. And I started noticing that, like, each week, a new fascinating article was being published from someone here at Cedars-Sinai. First, I saw one, you know, that AI could accurately predict if a patient will need a C-section or not for delivery, a woman giving birth. Then they're predicting blood flow to the heart and accurately predicting if a patient was at risk for a heart attack. And then they actually did a study where they had cardiologists, they were using, you know, echocardiograms and different heart monitors. And they had the AI, the artificial intelligence, do some scans. And then they had doctors do the scans that they do every single day. And then they had to try to read the scans, and they asked them to see if they could tell which one was the artificial intelligence and which one was the doctor. And they were not able to differentiate. Not only that, but the same study found that the AI was more accurate. Oftentimes, radiologists and people who are doing scans, you know, they might see thousands and thousands of scans in their lifetime. But in just a matter of seconds, the AI can compare millions of scans to learn, you know, all the nuances of what they're looking for. And so they're more efficient, more accurate. They can help doctors to be better doctors and thus enhance the patient's lives. They have extremely accurate and perceptive diagnostics and predictive tools and decision-making support, so they can help the doctors decide what is the most likely outcome of different drugs or surgeries or interventions. They can reduce accidental deaths and injuries because they are so accurate. They increase precision and productivity because they work faster and more efficiently than humans. And they can often recognize things that humans are unable to perceive. So AI even has the ability not only to recognize all these things, but to innovate and generate new scientific knowledge and discoveries. So I think for all of these reasons, you can see why it is essential, and it really is a medical issue. This is not just something that's fascinating because of the ChatGPT, whatever it's called, you know, that everyone's talking about now. But this is really a medical issue and something that's transforming medicine. As I can tell, and as I think I just summarized, you know, what I've seen just here at my own hospital, just in the last few months, which is literally transformative. And I see how much the hospital is investing in it and how much it is radically changing healthcare and improving healthcare. And so it made me realize this is something that, you know, we have to, it's like I once heard someone say, you either get on the bus or you get run over by the bus. It's one of those types of technologies. It's the fourth industrial revolution. It's radically changing healthcare. It can improve lives. But of course, with all those innovations that I just mentioned and all the changes that are happening and all the new areas for research and improvement in healthcare, there's also obviously concerns. And there's many, many concerns, and I'm not going to be able to address all of them today. In fact, normally for this session, we try to keep it to 40 minutes. We could just spend the 40 minutes. I could just list all the concerns, and that would be our 40 minutes. So that's not what we're going to do. I'm just going to mention two. And then one that I have my own insight that either you're going to laugh at me, in which case I'll just, you know, end the Zoom and go cry. Or you'll say that I'm totally right and I'm brilliant, in which case, you know, we'll go for much more than 40 minutes. So I'll allow you to unmute yourselves and keep on talking. No, I'm just joking. But I have this idea that I want to, you know, try out on all of you. And I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on it. So that will be the third thing. That's not really about medicine in particular. But with medicine, there are so many concerns, so many issues that have been brought up. I'm not, like I said, I'm not going to go into all of them. They have to do with numerous issues, that we'll save for another time. Because some of them, like, for example, liability is a major concern that I think Judaism does have a lot to say about. You know, when a patient gets injured, what if we use one of these AI techniques? You know, I mentioned to you all these new predictive or diagnostic or decision-making support. Let's say a physician uses that AI and then it doesn't go well. Well, who gets blamed? Who does the patient blame? Who do they sue, right? This is a very American question in particular, but I'm joking. But, you know, who's liable? And what who we decide is liable says a lot about our values. So that's going to be an important topic that will, you know, it's for another time. What does it mean to be human? That is a major discussion, which we're not going to go into now. But what does it mean to be human, right? At what point, you know, one of the other issues that came up over AI was the person who worked for Google that started to relate to their AI as a sentient being. And they actually got fired over it because they thought that the AI was like a human, and that was like crossing a red line. But how do you define a human? You know, there's issues of confidentiality and autonomy, lots of other issues that we're just not going to go into now. But I'll tell you the two that I want to talk about, because I think we have to be ready for them. Because it, like I said, you know, I just saw in the last few months the major department that my own hospital started, and how this is growing and happening so quickly, and this is happening around the world. We have to be ready, and there are certain things that I think we have to especially have to be preparing for. So those are the two things that I want to mention now, and then I'll share with you my other kind of insight or, you know, idea, just to hear your reactions and your feedback. But the first issue relates to values. And the reason I bring that up is because there is a major issue, and one of the major debates happening right now in the world of AI, artificial intelligence or machine learning, is about explainability versus black box. What that means is that should AI have to be explainable? Meaning, should you have to be able to understand how it came to its conclusions, right? Right now, you can just plug in a patient's information into the AI, and like I gave the example of, you know, predicting a C-section or predicting a heart attack or, all these other areas that it could predict. So when it comes to predictability and explainability, this is one of the big areas of debate. And some argue that requiring AI to be explainable will make AI less accurate, right? And it'll slow down innovation. And many companies, they don't want to just give away the keys to the, you know, to the, like this ChatGPT, for example. They were unique because they made it free and open to everyone. They want to help innovation. But oftentimes the companies want to keep their propriety over their innovations. And sometimes it's also very difficult to explain what they're doing. Sometimes they even have a hard time explaining it themselves. And if we want to keep it safe and enhance public trust, it might be essential that it's explainable. And the reason I bring this up is because even though, you know, there's this big debate, my first question here is like, okay, from a Jewish medical ethics perspective, from a Jewish law perspective, do we have an opinion about this? Should we just say, okay, I don't know, let them fight it out in Silicon Valley and they'll figure out what's best for the world? But no, I think we do have something to say about this. And it goes back to the debates about brain death, actually. What I'm trying to do here now is say, what precedent do we have in Jewish law, in Jewish values, in Jewish medical ethics that can help us to navigate new fields of medicine? And so the brain death debate actually helps us here. How? What does this have to do with brain? Well, it has a lot to do with brains, right? Because AI is so much modeled after human brains. But that's not why we're going with this. And not, I'm not talking about death and killing AI, which we are going to talk about, actually. But that is another issue. Let me show you why this is related to the brain death debate. When the Harvard criteria came out that really helped to establish determining death by neurological criteria, there was a great article in the Annals of Internal Medicine in 1981. I'm going to show it to you, but I'll also read it. Here it is. And here's what Dr. James Burnett and Charles Culver and Bernard Gert wrote in the Annals of Internal Medicine in 1981. A very important point they made, which was, a proper understanding of the ordinary meaning of the word or concept of death must be developed before a medical criterion of death is chosen. We must decide what is commonly meant by death before physicians can decide how to measure it. Providing the definition is primarily a philosophical task. The choice of the criterion is primarily medical, right? In other, let me say that line. That's the key line. The definition of death is primarily a philosophical task. The choice of the criterion is primarily medical. And the selection of the tests to prove that criterion is satisfied as solely a medical matter. So, of course, determining death is a medical issue. But defining death is a philosophical, religious, ethical issue. Rabbi Michael Broyd wrote about this I think he said it very well in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2001. Reasonable people agree that human tissue loses its status as a person before there is complete cellular lysis, right? Some of the body could still be alive. There could be some cellular reproduction happening after a patient is determined to be dead, but cannot agree on whether humanness legally disappears when brain function ceases, cardiopulmonary function ceases, or some other criterion is met. The question is, at its core, not a medical question, but a moral or religious one. To a religious person, death is the departure of the soul from the body. To a secular person, death is the point at which human rights no longer apply. Medicine cannot provide answers to either of these questions. There is, right, a philosophical, religious, spiritual aspect to these issues. I think Rabbi Dr. J.D. Bleich also said it in as is his manner, in an especially stark way. So I'm going to just read this. This is the last source on this issue, and then we'll discuss before we go on to the next issue. Rabbi Bleich said this at a conference. So it'll sound a little funny because it's written in kind of colloquial terms, but this is just a transcript from a conference that he attended on Jewish medical ethics in Switzerland in 2008. And here's what he said. We are dealing with the allegation that a decision to treat or not to treat is a medical decision. To me, this sounds absolutely bizarre. I understand very well there is no one, professional or otherwise, better qualified to diagnose the physiological cause of a disease, no one better qualified to identify alternative modes of therapy, no one better qualified to make a prognosis with regard to the prospective course of the illness, with or without treatment, than a physician. Those are things that doctors are trained to do. Those are things they know how to do well, and those are matters with regard to which non-medical people are not competent. But after the doctor has diagnosed the illness, after he or she has given advice with regard to treatment options, after they have assessed the ultimate outcome with regard to treatment or without treatment, the question of whether or not a treatment option is actually to be implemented is not a medical decision. It's a moral decision. For a Jew, it is a religious decision. It is a halachic decision. The doctor has no particular expertise in ethics, morality, or religious teaching. Whether or not to institute therapy is an entirely different order of question. It is a moral judgment and should be addressed by people having expertise in such matters. Moral judgments should be made by persons trained in dealing with such questions. Just as medical judgments are made by physicians trained in dealing with medical issues, I'm saying that doctors should not make treatment decisions in light of contemporary mores, but that rabbis, rebbeim, should make such decisions in light of ethical values of Jewish teaching. So what's being pointed out here, and why I'm bringing this up, is that when we come to this whole debate of the black box versus the explainability of artificial intelligence, it seems clear to me that anyone in particular who comes from a religious or cultural minority, someone who makes their decisions differently than the average person, who is who they use when they make these models, right? They scan, how did a billion people make these decisions? And let's see what the average person would decide. You're right, Julie. That's a good point. It's a financial decision as well, and that's also very relevant and a very, very good point. But when we're debating this issue, we can't just say, you know, whatever the average person would do, whoever programmed this AI thinks is right, that's just what we'll say is right. But someone who comes from a religious minority or from a group that might make decisions differently than the average citizen should be, I think, especially concerned that that they can understand where the AI's decisions are, how they're being made, or that there is AI that can support, you know, that is explainable, so that we can then determine how it made this decision, if this is accurate according to my values. This actually brings up a whole bit another issue that's being debated a lot lately, which is about AI rabbis, right? Can we just program the AI and say, like, okay, what is your value system? Oh, you're an Orthodox Jew? Okay, well, we have an Orthodox AI. It was programmed based on, it scanned thousands and thousands of responsa of Orthodox rabbis, or your Reform, whatever it is. And we've scanned thousands of responses, and we can output what they would say. The problem is, of course, you know, every single situation is unique, and everything depends on so many factors of every unique individual. And the person standing before you, it requires that kindness, that compassion, that recognition of that circumstance. And some would say, by the way, that rabbis, when they act appropriately, I mean, this is going to sound, you know, biased, because I am a rabbi. I know I'm speaking mostly to non-rabbis here, but that there is some kind of divine support that like when a rabbi makes a decision, and you can say this about other people as well, but that there's like some kind of divine assistance. Will that divine assistance be applied to the AI as well? But anyways, that's a side point. But really the issue I'm talking about here is just, you know, the transparency of the AI. And I know that some will argue that it's not so simple always to have a transparency with very complex AI. But maybe what I'm arguing is that advocacy might be necessary to ensure that we use more simple models, which can then be made competitive with the more complex models, and that maybe the more complex models should be designed to be more intelligible so they can be understood. Or that we don't have to use the most complex systems, and we may be better off with a simple model if we know it matches our values. And so here's the suggestion I want to make in this regard. And then we'll go to the next topic, and then I'll make my final suggestion, and then I want to hear your feedback and comments. And again, looking to the history and precedent in the world of Jewish medical ethics, I want to suggest that if we want to be responsible about AI, because as I gave you in the introduction, in the opening, it is happening rapidly in hospitals and in healthcare throughout the country. It's here, right? And it's happening. And it's going to be how, you know, doctors are trained in the future, as we'll talk about in the next bit in a second. But if it would be essential to have certain people who have technical expertise, who are trained to understand and interpret a given AI decision, and that they could be, you know, there could be certain religious experts that are trained to be like the mashgichot, mashgiach. I said mashgichot because I said in the feminine, because my precedent for this is that when surrogacy and artificial and various artificial support was being created, not artificial intelligence, but artificial reproductive technologies and artificial insemination, many rabbis were very concerned at first and were reluctant to allow it. And what happened was the rabbis allowed it under two caveats. And there was a few caveats, but two that are relevant for us. One is that they required that there be a supervisor in the labs. Actually, you can go on Netflix today. There's a lab that was uncovered in the Midwest that actually the doctor was impregnating his patients. And there's hundreds, literally, he had hundreds of children of unsuspecting patients who this doctor impregnated. It's a very sad story. That there's a documentary on Netflix about it now, but it has happened in history. And so what the rabbis were saying was, this is such a, you know, a risky and delicate area, right? We're getting people pregnant in such artificial manner that, of course, it's a great thing. If people want to be able to can't get pregnant otherwise, and it's a beautiful blessing to help them get pregnant. But because there were so many concerns about, you know, who's the mother, who's the father, how, you know, who's the child, might they marry a sibling accidentally, right? So they required supervisors. And this actually exists around the world. We have this in Los Angeles. People can go to a reproductive specialist, and for example, in the Orthodox community, and they can request and there's an organization that provides them. And throughout Los Angeles, and this is just, I'm just talking about it here, but this is true throughout the country, throughout the world, there's an organization that will provide a mashgiach, a supervisor that is not paid. You know, this is a volunteer thing, that they're not paid by the lab, because that would be a conflict of interest. And they actually supervise the entire process from start to finish. I actually spent a week in Shaar Tzedek Medical Center in Jerusalem, and I spent a day in their lab there, in their reproductive lab there, and they have a whole crew, and they have women there. The reason they use women is for modesty, that if so they can be there from the very start with the women until the end, and they supervise. And just like they have these mashgichot, and in addition to that, the rabbis required that when it comes to surrogacy, to gestational surrogacy, the rabbis said, we have to know the identity of the surrogate, or at least some basic identifying factors. Because if we say that the surrogate gestational carrier is considered the mother by Jewish law, we have to be careful that also, again, a sibling doesn't marry each other. And so the rabbis required some basic identity. They didn't want to have suppression of the identity of the surrogate or the donors. So I want to argue that just like in the past of Jewish medical ethics, when it came to artificial reproductive technology, there is a requirement for religious experts to be supervising the process, and a prohibition against suppressing the identity of the individuals involved. So too, I believe that there's a need for transparency and specially trained individuals to ensure that AI is fair and inclusive of a given patient's own value systems. So that's my point number one, that we should be thinking already in the Jewish community. For example, do we have people who are religious and trustworthy and also have the technical expertise to be able to understand AI, who can serve as liaisons, and that when a decision is being made using AI, a religious individual can say, can we have this expert help to guide us and ensure that whatever decisions are being made in the decision support process, there's no such kind of sort of contradiction against our values, and they're being made in accordance with our values, because we might lose touch with the decisions that are being made by the AI. And by the way, I'm just going to say as a brief side point, this issue of explainability is even theoretically an existential threat to humanity. I actually have this book. I read two books recently on AI. If you're curious, they're amazing books. And there's this one. It's called The Precipice by Toby Ord, Existential Risk and the Future of Humanity. And the other one that I read is called The Alignment Problem, Machine Learning and Human Values by Brian Christian. And then in addition to that, a great article that it says it's an article, but it's actually not an article. It's basically a book that isn't totally in Hebrew. But actually, I'll pull it up for you and show it to you just in case if you're curious. That I also read on this topic, just because if you want to have all the interesting issues, there's this article. I'll hold it up. I'll show you. It's a 100-page article by Yaron Ben Zakkai in Israel. Yaron Ben Zakkai is one of the leading thinkers in this topic, and he wrote just a fascinating article on this, and he's really doing some really important work. So anyways, why am I bringing this all up? Yaron Ben Zakkai's article, by the way, I should just say it if in case you're curious. The name of his article is Ha'im Nachon Limsor Hachlatot Bedini Nefashot Kiberefuah LeTechnologiot Tomchot Hachlata. Decision Support Technologies in Halacha. He has 100 pages on the topic. And why do I say this is an existential threat? What are you holding up there, Dr. Wilner?
It's a book written in the late 80s, Silicon Dreams, about what machines can do.
Interesting.
With artificial intelligence back then. And they said certain things would never happen. And they have happened.
Uh-huh. Right.
So a lot of these books, even the books that,
yes,
that are out now,
no, 100%.
Go past them.
Yes, exactly. That's why I've been listening to some interviews with some of the leading experts in AI, and they ask them questions. Will we be ever able to do such and such? And they all say, well, technically, no. I don't think we could do it. But then again, I don't think we could do what we're doing today. And so actually, probably the answer is yes. The concern, by the way, just as a side point before I move to the next topic, is, you know, the reason why Ord argues that this is an existential threat to humanity, if not advanced wisely, is because he argues that AI will likely become more intelligent and skilled than humans. And therefore, if it's not aligned with human goals and values, it could become motivated to take over control of the future from humanity for its own interests, which could be an existential threat if you think about it, because everything is integrated. We put the world on autopilot, right? Our phones, our cars, our homes are all being controlled by AI, and we don't even know what's controlling it. And if the AI became so integrated and was unaligned with our values, it could actually become, Ord, this book by The Precipice by Toby Ord, he talks about what he thinks are the four biggest threats to human survival. He wrote this in 2019, by the way, before COVID. He says the four biggest threats are pandemics, nuclear war, climate change, and artificial intelligence. And of those four, he demonstrates why AI is the biggest threat for that reason. And this is why there's so much, in my opinion, so much concern about the black box, the unexplainability. And I think especially from a Jewish perspective, we need to be able to explain it. And we need to have professionals who can support our community in ensuring that it is explainable. That's issue number one. Number two, let's go to number two, and then a brief issue, and then we'll open it up for a conversation. So issue number two is, in some ways, a smaller issue. And this I'm really talking now, not just as, you know, a rabbi, as a Jew, I'm talking here mostly now as a chaplain. And this is the issue of, you know, the more AI becomes integrated into the clinic, into hospitals, really, it's taking up so much of a doctor's job. Some people are worried, their big worry is doctors are going to lose jobs. It's becoming so much more efficient and so much more effective and accurate, doctors will lose their jobs. This is what happens every time there's a new technology, as everyone worries that everyone's going to lose their jobs. And then they find other jobs based on, and thanks to the new technology. But I just want to bring it up because there is this issue of, you know, the more machines, and the truth is, as a chaplain, you can actually Google, don't do it right now, wait till we're done, but you can actually Google robo-chaplain. There is, in Japan, there was a company that developed a robo-chaplain, and it's just an arm and a speaker. The arm is used, it has a hand that like pats a person's shoulder and comforts them, and it says like phrases, you will be okay, I am here with you, do not worry. So, but imagine as medicine becomes more and more, you know, machine learning, computerized, artificial intelligence, what about the role of what we call refuah hanefesh, right? In the Misha Berach prayer, we say, we pray for someone to have refuah taguf and refuah tanefesh. Actually, I said it backwards because we say first, refuah tanefesh, refuah taguf. We believe that healing comes from healing of the soul and healing of the body, right? It's essential for a person to be cared for holistically, right? There was a great poem, a great medieval poem by Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Gamriel. He had this line, this great line. He said, V'hadalim tirachem. If someone is, destitute, have mercy on them. Ha'avelim tenachem. Those who are mourning, comfort them. V'acholim, and the sick, tasichem. Talk to them. There's a value of having someone who's empathic, compassionate, supportive, that you have a relationship with for many years in the healthcare environment. And one of the big concerns is, what happens if healthcare becomes so computerized, so much based on algorithms? What will be lost? What will be lost when there's not the human touch, right? And I'm just going to show you a couple of sources and then make a couple of suggestions about that before, which is, you know, there's this great piece in the Tzitz Eliezer. The Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, was the rabbi of Shari Tzedek Medical Center in Yerushalayim. When he's talking about, he has this tshuva in the section of Ramat Racha when he talks about medical issues. He has a section where he's talking about Bikur Cholim, visiting the sick. And he says, what's the main thing? In Halacha, we usually say the main thing is praying. Praying for the patient, advocating for them, cleaning their room, all kinds of things like that, just helping the patient. But he says, you know, there is another aspect to it. He says, Od Mosif Kasuv is Sefer Charedim. Sefer Charedim says as follows, Shehadibur Yafel Lecholim. It's good to talk. It's good to have someone to talk to, someone to empathize with. Some Ulachain Yadakte Kamavaker Leilech Lechola Kishain Sham Ish. It's good to go visit someone when no one else is there. Sha'az nefesh achola mara alav, because that's when he feels really bitter, really alone. Bihioso yechidi, when he's lonely. V'efshar lavoli de tiruf das. And they could come to the state of tiruf hadas. Tiruf hadas, real quick, let me just explain what that is, because it's really important. The concept of tiruf hadas is, it comes from the Mishnah. In the Mishnah, it talks about a woman who's giving birth and she's very afraid. And she's so afraid that she says to the midwife, could you please light a fire so that you can see better? Because I'm nervous. So the Gemara says, yes, you can light a fire for it on Shabbos. On Shabbat, you can light a fire, which is prohibited on Shabbat. You can light a fire because it comforts her. And it says, this is even true if she's blind, meaning it doesn't even necessarily, it's not that they need it to see better, but she just needs to know that the doctor has the better sight. Even if the midwife says, no, I can see fine, but it puts you at ease, so you can violate even Torah prohibitions for the sake of protecting a patient's acute mental anguish. We believe in the significance of mental anguish. This is part of healing. Part of healthcare is helping a person emotionally and spiritually, not just physically. So he goes on and he says, they could come to, you know, acute mental anguish here, but sometimes through the talking, it can help them to relieve some of their suffering. And in fact, the Gemara says in a beautiful, very important line here in Mishlei, it quotes Mishlei, which is Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 12 says, Daga b'levish yashchena. But wait, did I pronounce it right? Daga b'levish yashchena means if someone has dread, squash it, right? Quash it, yashchena. Rabbi Ami v'Rabbi Asi. Chad Amar says, Yashchena midato. Yashchena midato means crush it from your mind. Just don't think about it. Distract yourself. V'chad Amar, no. What it means is, Yasichena la'acherim. Talk about it with someone else. You need someone to talk through things. Sometimes when you're struggling, when we're suffering, you need someone to talk it out, to talk through things, and that helps to comfort a person. Just having an AI machine tell you what to do and kind of make all your decisions for you and provide your health care is not going to comfort you in this way. And by the way, you might be thinking to yourself, well, is the main thing having someone to talk to? Some patients, either they're introverts, or there's too much talking, or they can't talk, or they don't want to talk anymore. So by the way, the Gemara says, you know, in Yisro, Moshe advised Yisro, it says, V'odat lehem es aderech asher yechuba. Tell them the way they should go. So the Gemara darshins, it infers something from each word. V'odat lehem es aderech. Each way it says, oh, this teaches you how to make a living. This teaches you how to do a funeral. This teaches you how to support a bride. Each word is something else. So the Gemara says we learn the value of Bikur Cholim from one of those words, from visiting the sick. Which word? Yelchu. The Gemara says when it said Yelchu, Zu Bikur Cholim. So what does that mean? Bikur Cholim, you learn about, it means going? So the Marsha, on the Gemara there, the Marsha says, Debalichasu Sham Belachud, Bli Shum Maisa Mekaima. Just by showing up, without doing or saying anything, sometimes that is the main thing. Sometimes just having someone show up and be there for you. It's not about what they say. It's just that they care, that they're there for you, that they're showing their support. That is important for people. And the concern I'm, you know, either they lose touch with the outside world by visiting them, you can help them, you can give them, you can inform them about they're missing about the community, or you're there with them. So I'm bringing this up because of the concern that, you know, of course it's going to be important that we still care for patients compassionately, humanistically, empathically, the whole person support. And, you know, when I asked Dr. Moore, the head of our AI program here at Cedars-Sinai about this, he gave me what I thought was a very interesting response, a very good response. He said, look, AI will help in this regard. Why will it help? It will free up clinicians' time, because so much of the tedious and difficult work that they had to do in the past will now be able to be done instead by these machines, and that will help the doctors to have more free time. So if the clinicians increase free time could be given to patients by supporting them, and they have more time to develop relationship, to provide compassion and empathy, that would be a great thing. Of course, there's a risk to that as well, because it could end up happening if we're not careful. And this is why I think this is one of the things to bring up now, before it totally takes over our lives, that clinicians' free time could be taken up by having to explain the AI and the various new options. AI could give multiple options that we never thought of in the past. So now the doctor might just have to spend their time explaining all the options in the AI, or the health system will say, look, we are a business. Doctor, kind of like Judy pointed out too, right? About the financial issues, they might say, we're a business. So I'm glad that the doctors have more free time now. So what we'll do then is require them to see more patients per day. And they'll have less time with each patient. That would be, I think, a tragedy. But that could happen. What needs to happen, though, in my opinion now, is that medical schools need to start really training medical students in the use of AI and care of patients in with empathy, either that or invest in more chaplains and social workers. They need to start filling up hospitals with, there need to be people that are dedicated to caring about the whole person, as we saw from these sources. And there's many, many more. This is just a taste of the importance that Judaism applies to refuat ha-nefesh, caring for the whole person, not just the illness. A person is not just the disease, right? They are a whole person, and we should be caring for that whole person. And yes, Deborah, thank you. This is why I'm going to use this to advocate, of course, for more chaplains, but people will go many ways with it. There was a great quote I was thinking of in this regard, of Dr. William Osler, one of the founders of modern medicine. Dr. Osler said that a good physician treats the disease, but the great physician treats the patient. And the risk is AI can treat the disease, but can it treat the patient? And we should be thinking about that. Let me go now to my last point, and then I want to hear any feedback you have and wrap up, because we try to keep these sessions to 45 minutes or so. Here's my last point, and this is when I'm asking you not to laugh at me, but you might laugh at me, and if you do, that's fine. You just won't be my friend anymore. I'm joking. I want to hear your honest opinion. So I've just been thinking about this a lot, because I'm thinking about AI a lot lately, and as I showed you from these books, reading about it, and it's real. I mean, it's here, as I explained at the beginning, it's here, and it's increasing, and it's the future. It's the present. So here's another issue that I want to just bring up. That we need to think about also. So we know that we won't get sentient AI, right? I mean, real sentient AI, like, is AI human, like human-like, that has emotions and feelings? Because first, what we'll have to have is AI that can suffer. And we humans have to think about how we treat AI. I mean, do we have to think about it? Maybe you say, we don't have to think about it. Who cares? It's not human. And that would be ridiculous to suggest that it is. And I agree. It's not human at all. It's not even an animal, right? AI is not a life form. The problem is, experientially, it's becoming more and more like a life form. And people have a tendency to make other things suffer, right? If you look at human history, it's a history of people doing bad things to lots and lots of people. And we create the AI that we want, right? And so we create AI to get points, right, or to accomplish things. And but they've done other things that they can't do, or they'll lose interest in doing the things. And at what point, the programmers lose interest in those things. And this AI is just like on this mission to accomplish things that we don't care about anymore. It's like spends months running in circles, literally. And at what point, when a program can't fulfill its wants, does that program feel pain? Now, again, I don't think that AI really feels pain. But if we cause it to feel pain and we relate to AI almost as a human, we talk to it, we have conversation with it, we open up about it. There's AI that people are now treating as therapists, literally. And the AI is actually pretty good at it to a certain extent. And we have, if you relate to the AI as a kind of a person, you have a relationship in a way. So should we not feel some kind of sympathy for what happened to them? And there's actually a group, you can Google this, there's a group called People for the Ethical Treatment of Reinforcement Learning Agents. But it might sound ridiculous, but, AI deep learning happens when AI is programmed to receive rewards for accomplishing certain functions and penalties for not accomplishing them. So there are, for example, does it matter that we program AI to play Super Mario Brothers for 4 months straight and it gets stuck in the same loop? And ad absurdum. Maybe that sounds ridiculous to care about that. But how about this? There was a case. It's actually reported in this book, The Alignment Problem, that I mentioned to you. There was a case. Listen. This is crazy. AI was programmed to seek novelty, right? To create new things, to come up with new avenues. But it was put into a situation where, at a certain point, it could create no more novelty. There was no more novelty. But it's a novelty-seeking robot. So the AI is assigned a task that not only is it seeking novelty, but then the programmers gave it a penalty that every second that it's not coming up with a new novelty, it is penalized for that. So now it's stuck because the AI is trying to come up with new things, but it's penalized for not coming up with new things. So the AI is like going crazy. And in this case, the AI killed itself. The AI killed itself. I mean, it's like shocking. Okay, you could word it differently. You could say, oh, the AI just turned off. But in a way, experientially, you could have an AI that you have a relationship with. You talk to it. It helps you. It guides you. And then you give it something to do that is so difficult for it that it suffers and it complains and then it dies. And what does that do to us as people if we feel like, oh, but it's not like even an animal. I can be cruel to it. I can have fun with it because this is fun. I can make the AI suffer and I can torture the AI. And what does that do to us as people? Right? What does it do us as people? And I want to bring this up. I just want to show you one source in this regard, because I think that there are issues. There are sources on this. People think I'm crazy when I bring this up, but I'm not. I'm right. Okay, maybe I'm wrong, but I think I'm right. Okay, when it comes to the issue of tsar balei chayim, making animals suffer, there is a prohibition in the Torah. We're not allowed to make animals suffer, right? So the Rambam, I put up here on the screen, the Rambam writes in the Mor Nevuchim, part 3, chapter 48, that the reason for the prohibition against making animals suffer is because animals have feelings. That's what he says, right? The reason we can't, concerning animals is, he says here, I'll just read it in English because it wasn't written in Hebrew anyways originally. The law enjoins that the death of the animal should be the easiest. It is not allowed to torment the animal by cutting the throat in a clumsy manner, by polo axing, or by cutting off a limb whilst the animal is alive. He says this also applies to the prohibition against killing an animal with its young on the same day. For he says, for the pain of the animal under such circumstances is very great. There's no difference in this case between the pain of a man and the pain, or a woman, and the pain of living other living beings. Since the love and tenderness of the mother for her young ones is not produced by reasoning, which only humans have, he argues, but by imagination, which also animals have. And this faculty exists not only in man, but also in most living beings. And so the Rambam goes on to say, this is also why we have to send away the mother bird. The law provides that such grief should not be caused to cattle or birds. How much more careful must we be that we should not cause grief to our fellow humans? Okay, that's the Rambam's opinion. I'm not saying that AI is like animals. But what the Ramban, Nachmanides, disagrees. Look at the Ramban. The Ramban, when he talks about sending away the mother bird, this is here in Devarim, Perek Chav Beis, the Ramban says the reason for the prohibition against making animals suffer is, he says, Lefisha ose midosav shal kadosh baruch hu rachmim ve'enu ela gezeros. Okay, the reason, Hashem's commandments, we don't understand the reasons, but it's for rachmim. Lomar, to me, means, shelo chasa el al kan tzipur, that God doesn't really care about the bird and the bird's nest. Or cares about killing an animal and its child the same day. God doesn't really feel bad for the animal dying. Because according to the Ramban, unlike the Rambam says, God's mercy and compassion does not extend to animals. But limnoa osein osanu milasos pem tarachinu. That's why God doesn't prevent us from doing our needs, like eating animals or wearing them or whatever else we do with animals. Shim kein haya osar shchita. If that was true, we wouldn't be allowed to shecht animals and eat them. Aval, here's the main line, and I think this applies to AI. You'll tell me what you think. Aval, tam hamania. The reason why we cannot make animals suffer, lilamed otanu midas harachmanus v'shelo nitachzar, to teach us to be merciful and not to cause us to be cruel. Ki achzarius tispashet benefesh ha'adam. Because otherwise, people are very easy to be cruel, and God doesn't want us to be cruel. So the reason we have to be kind to animals is because it teaches us bad manners. And in fact, I think you might all know this, that studies show that there is a connection between animal abuse and criminal activity, such like rape, homicide, domestic abuse, robbery. In fact, there's many cases of notorious serial killers that often had a history of animal abuse before that. And there was a study, a longitudinal study, that went for 21 years, and it found that 70% of animal abusers later went on to commit other crimes. 70%. Because there is something about when people can be cruel to animals, they don't have mercy or compassion or empathy. And I want to argue that in addition to these other concerns that I mentioned, that we should have explainability of AI, that we should be able to, still live in accordance with our values with AI, and that also we should be concerned about compassion and empathy in the clinic, in the healthcare setting, that either doctors should be trained, especially to utilize AI and also to use their free time to be extra compassionate and to treat the whole person. I want to argue that we should also be training ourselves right now to be compassionate to AI. And that being cruel to AI is like being cruel to animals. But I want to be clear. I'm not saying that AI is an animal, is a living being. I'm not saying that. I don't think it is. I think that's ridiculous. But I think that our children are growing up in a world where AI is like a person. It's like a friend. It's like a, and if they're and we should be training people to be kind to them, because that's just good mitos, that's just good manners. And it could be so easy to just say, oh, it's not human, it's not even animal, so therefore I can be cruel to that. I can make the AI do whatever I want and just kind of torture the AI. It's fun, it's funny, it's really funny. But it's not nice, it's not kind, and we have to be careful about how we treat the AI for those reasons, because it really has an impact on us. And if we want to maintain, forget about the issue of who's a human, what does it mean to be human today, but if we want to maintain our humanity and our own compassion, our own kindness in the world that's rapidly changing, where AI is taking over the world, we have to also have ethics, not just of how the AI interacts with us, but how we interact with the AI. So those are the three issues that I wanted to bring up. I know we're basically out of time. So if you put in the chat that you want me to send the source sheet, I'm happy to send it. Just put in the chat your email address, and then after we're done, I'll send out the source sheet to everyone. If there's any comments, I know we have to wrap up, but any burning, you know, comments, critiques, questions, I'd love to hear what you think about these. It obviously deserves a lot more time. There's a lot more to say, but I just wanted to kind of scratch the surface with these issues, because it's so important and so pressing. Any initial comments? Yeah, good points. We that's why we have to be thinking about these things and really ready for the changing world. And yes, Melissa, I see your comment in the chat. I do plan to present on this topic in other settings, because, like I said, there's so many more issues. I just wanted to bring up these couple of issues to start with, but there's a lot more. And just remind Melissa, if you got an email from me this morning about this, that means you're on my email list, and you'll get more. If you're not, if you didn't get an email this morning from me, then let me know, and I'll put you on my list where I send out when I do these kinds of discussions.
Just get the reminders from NAJC.
Right. So in this particular forum today, this is through the NAJC, but sometimes I'll do it separately. So if you want, I'll add you to my
That's
distribution
great.
List.
I just put my email address in there, so you'll see it. That's
okay, great.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
How do we contact you to do that?
Well, you know, I'll put my email address also in the chat.